At my last church, which I took over, as many of you know, a defunct church plant that had 19 members that had fallen apart, gone from 180 people down to 19, was meeting in a school. It wasn't doing well. They contacted me. The mother church that planted it, Liz and I had actually attended that when we got married, so they knew me. They contacted me in Arizona, asking me if I would, pour my life into this little struggling church plant. I actually took that job with 19 members and two kids and moved there, stayed there 19 years, and learned much about ministry in that little church plant. As we tried to, when you have 19 people would be like the first couple of rows here. When you have just a handful of people, it's hard to build critical mass because we were surrounded by some big mega churches. And so typically people would go to the big mega church. They would say, hey, we love your preaching, teaching and stuff, but yeah, I got kids and they got a huge program. So sorry, we can't come here. And it was very hard to get traction. And so what Liz and I would do is we would open our home up. I don't know how you feel, but we like to play games. I mean, like board games and stuff. We're like both super competitive. And it's a great way to find out about people is play a game with them and you'll find out whether you don't need to be at the church. You need to go to this other church. It was a lot of fun. So we had all kinds of evenings of playing games in our house. And then it caught on and other people opened their homes for games. And so it was just a huge thing. But our house was kind of like the core house. And so all the young couples and stuff would come over. The kids would run wild in the backyard doing stuff. And we would just have a great time playing Pictionary. Guys always lost because the women could draw one thing and guess it. You know, like that happened one time. One lady drew an ark and some lady yelled, birdcage. You know, the guys over here drawing this detailed mechanical bird. Yeah, anyway, we had lots of fun stories, but... But something so innocent became something very destructive because of one person. It just takes one person. And so all those core couples, we would rotate them around. So as it got bigger and more people were involved, we couldn't have everybody in our small 1,500 square foot house. And so we were limited to how many couples would come. And then after a while, we started, hey, I really like that couple. Because, if your wife gets along with her and him and you get along with, that didn't happen much. And so we kind of isolated some that were like, well, I think we could be really good friends with them. We'd have them more often in our home, etc. Well, there was a woman who was part of that core group great woman, but we just didn't feel like they would be our best friends. They were good friends, but not our best friends. And so we didn't invite them over as much as we had because we have many other people to attend to. So on Fridays and Saturdays, when these things typically occurred, she would drive by our house. Why'd you say, uh-oh? She'd drive by our house and she'd take notes of whose cars were parked in front of my house. Because she knew who they were. It's a small church. Here, I wouldn't know. There, you did. Oh, you got them over. Oh, you got them over. That's the third Friday night in a row they've been over. We have not. Oh, I'm taking notes. And she did this for weeks. Took notes, months, took notes. And then she, in holy righteousness, confronted my wife over the sin of ostracizing them. It was unbelievable. How dare you have so-and-so over three times in a row? It's been a month since we've been over. What kind of people are you? Don't you care about us? On and on and on she went. And Liz is, why don't you defend yourself from something like that? Because we're free to invite over who we want. And funny how they would never invite us over to their home. And so she got extremely upset and eventually left the church in what I would call a holy huff. Holy huff. I just shake the dust off this church off my feet. These people just aren't friendly. Liz and I are like, what in the world? I mean, what just happened? Wouldn't you be asking yourself that? Like, what just happened? And then the follow-up question, why'd that happen? And as we have thought about it, back then and over the years and have talked about it, what was our problem? It was two things. It was jealousy and it was envy, these two things. And they're not the same. I did a bunch of reading this week to isolate the differences between jealousy and envy. And basically what I read from different professors, psychologists, blah, blah, blah. Here's the difference between the two terms, which both of those sins plagued this woman. Jealousy. What is jealousy? Which relates to this lady, we'll call her Christy. Jealousy is you have something And somebody else is beginning to take that away from you, and you don't like that, so you will do things to stop that. You're jealous of that person's power that they have over you. So she had our friendship, but only to a degree. And she wanted more of that friendship, but she's losing that friendship to not be what she wants it to be. And so she's jealous of anybody that's at my house for dinner. Envy? Envy is somebody has something that you want, you don't have it, and you desire that above all things. So related to Christy, what did she want? She wanted to be on the inside core track to be the pastor and his wife's best friends. And she would do anything down to confronting the pastor's wife to make that happen. That didn't go well. And she didn't get what she wanted. And then we saw what kind of person that she was. And then we really don't want to be friends with her. Jealousy and envy. You ever struggle with that? It's a terrible thing. It's very destructive. James, our Lord's brother, said this about jealousy and envy. He says in chapter 3, verse 14, if you have bitter jealousy, which this woman did, and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, and demonic. It's from the devil. It's from the devil. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is order and peace in everything. No, there is disorder in every evil thing. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceful, gentle, reasonable. She was not reasonable. Full of mercy. She was not merciful. Had good fruits, unwavering, and without hypocrisy. Well, this woman, Christy, struggled with jealousy and struggled with envy. And because she struggled with those, she brought her chaos to the church. And because she brought her chaos to the church, it was very destructive. Because it then permeates to other relationships. You struggle with jealousy and envy. I have at times. You know, you're struggling hard as a pastor to get things off the ground. I've been there with a little tiny church. Another guy comes along. This really happened. He builds a church where they really don't teach the word like you should. Very, very California, very, you know, cutting edge. Two or three new members a year, I was happy. He was getting, you know, 150, 200, you know, per year. I mean, growing, flourishing. Don't you think that another pastor looks at that? Because in your humanness, you're like, you know, why him? I'm preaching the word here, and I'm dealing with Christy. And you're you got him flourishing up there. What's the deal, God? So don't tell me that you don't struggle with it, because it just creeps up at the most unbelievable times. So if you struggle with bouts of jealousy and envy, today's the day to talk about it. Because there's a man in the Old Testament that had these problems like Christy did nothing about them, and they destroyed him. His name is Saul. He's very jealous and very envious of a man who's being used of God, David. And so there's much to learn from this episode of Saul's jealousy and envy. And we want to dig into it, not just to study it and have an academic understanding of it, but to say, Lord, you know, is that me? And if it is me, then I confess that. And I ask you to help me have victory over that and learn to bless those around me, be thankful for what you're doing in their life, but to grow from it instead of using it as a weapon. For Saul, it became a weapon. So in this passage, everything starts out great. It's like me having these groups with all these young couples coming over. It's great. Church is growing. Things seem great. Just when you think things are going great, as you get older, you start thinking, it's going to go south. Something's going to happen. And so we first encounter what I call the unification in verses 1 to 5. After David kills Goliath, wow, this young kid took on this giant with a slingshot and hit him with one stone while he was running. Unbelievable. So we have this great moment of unification. Verse 1, it came about when he had finished speaking to Saul, chapter 17, that the soul of Jonathan, the king's son, was knit together to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him, David, as himself. And Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house in Bethlehem, over in that region. And then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. He's told you twice that he loved him as himself. Very interesting passage. According to Numbers chapter 1, verse 3, you had to be over 20 years old to serve in the Israeli military. So since David had been in various military campaigns, he's probably a lot older than David, who's just a teenager. So you have a seasoned warrior, the king's son, Jonathan, and then this young shepherd who just killed Goliath, this massive military machine. And it says that David and Jonathan, when they got in close proximity to each other, that Jonathan's like, that's a guy that I want to know. I mean, he what do you think drew Jonathan to David? I think two things. Number one, Jonathan saw that you could use an inferior force to take on a superior force. He knew that from his own life because that's how he was a warrior, and we've already studied his exploits, whether he fought with just his armor bearer or by himself. The man was unbelievable. The other thing that I think he saw in David was what he said in chapter 14, verse 6, before he went on a military campaign to attack the Philistines. He says, "Nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few." He had great faith in God. And so that great faith in God, he sees it in David, and he's like, this is somebody I want to know. Haven't you ever run into somebody? And it's very rare when it happens. You run into somebody and you know after just a few minutes of being exposed to them, I got to know them. And I'm going to know them. That was kind of the situation. What was the motivating reason as why they knit their souls together? And the word for knitting here in the Hebrew text talks about taking two pieces of rope and tying it together to make it really strong. Because you are stronger when you have a great friend. And so David and Jonathan say, you know what? We're two single strands of rope, but we want to knit our lives together. And what was that which knit their lives together? They loved each other. They did. So is it possible for a man to love another man? Yeah. Yeah. But we do, as I have to stop and address this as a side note, because the LGBTQI plus community, blasphemous in how they interpret this text. Because they say, aha, here's an illustration of two young men who had a homosexual relationship. Does the text say that? No. And I will give you clarity through the Hebrew why it doesn't say that. The word used here that they loved each other in the Hebrew text is called ahev. Ahev is love, all right? That is never used in the entire Old Testament of homosexual desire, not one time. The word that is used to describe homosexual activity is like in Genesis 18 and 19, is the word yada, to know. Like, this man knew that man, yada. Or this woman knew that woman. It's like in, I think if you go back to Genesis chapter 4, that Adam knew his wife Eve. It's yada. It's to know sexually. That word yada is never, you hear me, never used of David and Jonathan. Never. Why? What's at stake? Well, they didn't have a sexual relationship. They had a man-to-man relationship, and they loved each other. And I can identify as a man. There's a few men in my life, some of them died many years ago, that were my best friends, died from car accidents and disease and stuff. But I can say, you know, before mankind, those were my men in my life I loved, that I knew loved me beyond all things. So when it talks about this love they had for each other, it was love based on a great respect of who they were as men. And so it's okay for you as a man to tell another man who's your best friend, I love you. Have you done it? Yeah. Have you done it? My best friend, Alan Reasoner, that spent half his life in San Quentin and got saved in San Quentin. I have his Bible on my desk from San Quentin to remember Alan, who died in a car wreck or motorcycle wreck. Wow. He was the first guy in my life that one day, this tattooed, long-haired guy looked at me one day when Liz and I were newlyweds, and he was leaving our place, and he said, you know what, man, I love you. And I was like 22 years old. I didn't know what to do with it. I'm like, whoa. Yeah. And then it's like, this ex-con, this guy it's unbelievable. We became best friends. So anyway, it's just a side sermon, all right? Jonathan admires David because of what kind of man that he was. So what did Jonathan do? It says Jonathan stripped himself of his robe, his royal robe that was on him, and he gave it to David with his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. So his dad tried this before, remember? Because I told you, if David would have worn Saul's military garb into battle, then the battle would have been as if the king did it, and then Saul would have got the victory. And David said, I don't want your armor. Plus, it doesn't fit anyway because I'm short and you're really tall. David and Jonathan must have been similar in size because David takes the weaponry. What does that signify? That signifies that David's the king. That's what it signifies. So the king's son just said to this teenager, here's all my royal weaponry because I foresee that you are the man that God has chosen to be the king, not my dad. See, this is the selfless, mature gesture on Jonathan's part is refreshing and is not seen much in our world today, because anybody that's any kind of political power, as we can see, especially living here, will hang on to that power tooth and nail. They can be on an oxygen tank and still holding on to it. They don't want to give it up. Here you have a young man that says, you know what? I can see that you're the next anointed king. It's not my dad. And here, let me bless you with my royal robe and weaponry to show that I support you as the king. This sounds a lot like somebody in the New Testament. The trivia question. Last name is Baptist. First name, John. Yeah, John the Baptist. Yeah, John. At the height of his ministry, he's cranking, leading many people to Christ, baptizing in the Jordan River. Things are going great. But when he runs into Jesus, you know, I mean, he can't even take the sandals off his feet. He's a very humble man. And he makes this statement, which I think is one of the greatest statements in the Gospels, in John chapter 3, verse 30. He says of Christ, he must increase. I must what? Decrease. This is a hard thing for a man to say. That person needs to increase. I must decrease, because God's hand is on them, and I see it. Jonathan was a great man, because he knew how to step aside and let God use somebody else. It says in verse 5, David went out wherever Saul sent him and prospered, and Saul sent him out over the man, put him over the men of war. And it was pleasing in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of all Saul's servants. So things going good?
Yeah.
That's when you start looking around going, the devil is alive and real, and he works the relationships, and I wonder what's going to happen. Well, that's when we encounter what I call the deterioration. So the other was just this beautiful unification, and all of a sudden begins to deteriorate over two sins. I already mentioned them to you in the opening. What are the two sins? Jealousy and envy. Jealousy and envy. Verse 6, it happened as they were coming, when David returned from killing the Philistine, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul. And they had tambourines, their version of a Stratocaster. That's a guitar, by the way. They came out with tambourines, with joy, and musical instruments. If you go with me to Israel in the future, and our next trip in May is already full. It took 2 weeks to fill it up with 55 people. But when you go up to the Temple Mount area, on Fridays, on Shabbat, they're out there with tambourines, singing, and doing bar mitzvahs. It's exciting. But when kings would win battles and come into town, the young ladies would pour out into the streets, dancing and singing over victory. What are they singing? Verse 7. We don't know what the tune was, but you know what the lyrics were. And the women sang as they played, and they said, Saul has slain his thousands. It's hyperbolic, but you get the picture. And David, his tens of thousands. How'd that go over with Saul? So if you struggle with jealousy and envy, I can tell you for sure, there is something that triggers you. There's something. And you already right now are going, yeah, I know exactly what it is. You know, it's something triggers you. And so all of a sudden, this beautiful song, this innocent little thing, like having people over to my house for dinner and games, this thing becomes a huge thing to this one person, Christy. This beautiful song celebrating victory all of a sudden triggers Saul. And what does it say in verse 8? How did he rise up and just become all Pentecostal and giving hallelujah, praise God for David? Mm-mm. No, became very angry. He became very angry. The word in Hebrew means to, like, have a hot nose. How's that so? When you get really hopping mad, like the blood flows to your face and ends up in your nose, and you're just glowing with anger. That's kind of the Hebrew connotation. He became very angry, for the saying displeased him, and he said, this is so small-minded. They have ascribed to David 10,000s, but to me, they have ascribed thousands. Now, what more can he have but the kingdom? I mean, He just goes from, you're kidding me. They're extolling his greatness on the prowess on the battlefield. What about me? This is ridiculous. Why don't we just give him the kingdom? Well, Samuel had already told Saul twice that you just lost the kingdom because of your outright rebellion against God. But he didn't quite get the memo, like we are sometimes. Kind of hard-headed, didn't want to listen. And the kingdom is going to be ripped and given away to David. But Saul is jealous about the whole thing. So he became insanely jealous because he realizes this young man can take his power and prestige away from him, his position. He's jealous about that. And he's envious because David is more talented than he is. He goes out in battle with weaponry on his body. David goes out, no weaponry, and a little bag full of some rocks and a slingshot to take on a 10-foot-tall giant, armed to the teeth, and wins. You know, there's always somebody who's more intelligent than you, more skilled, more muscular, has a better six-pack as opposed to your one-pack, whatever, is quicker, they're more gifted, and on it goes. And the sooner that you realize that, the better you will be in life. There's always somebody that's just above you or beyond you. Have you? Well, let me share with you what happened to me. I learned this one the hard way. My senior year in college at Azusa Pacific University, I got a modular unit, and my modular unit was right on the left field fence. I was a left fielder in baseball. I went to Azusa to play baseball. I ended up not playing baseball because I wanted to give my life to studies, not to baseball. And God puts my modular unit on the left field fence. My desk faces the left fielder. I can smell the grass when it's cut in the spring. I hear them running around the field. I'm like, I'm sitting there studying Greek. I'm like, serious, you know? Yeah. So anyway, I move in this modular unit, and they assigned to me two sophomores, you know? And so they're moving in. And one of them moved in. I came in the modular unit one day in the living room, and there's a big old piano, like made in the 1900s, an old piano. But I'm like, awesome. I don't have to go to the practice rooms to play the piano anymore. It's right here in the living room. I can play. It's awesome. And I saw some music on it, a classical piece, like 1/16th notes, very fast. And I'm thinking, sweet, I love fast music. So I sat down and began to play. And I thought I was just all over this piece. And when I finished it, I was quite happy with myself. And so I went into my bedroom, closed the door. I hadn't seen my roommate yet. Pretty soon, as I'm in there studying, I hear that piece played twice as fast as I played it. I'm like, who's in the house, Rachmaninoff? I mean, I got up, I went out there, I looked around the corner, and there's this little skinny dude named Bob playing all up and down the keyboard. And he's playing, and he, what's up? And I'm like, Bob, what in the world? He goes, hey, man, how many years lessons did you take? 10. I'm like, how many did you take? 3. 3? 3 years. Yeah, I gave it up after 3. Gave it up. He said, I was a child prodigy. The minute I sat down, I just got it. And I'm a concert pianist. He went on to play for the Crystal Cathedral's evening services back in the day. I mean, a concert pianist. I mean, I just bowed before his ability. And I learned there's always somebody better. And if you don't embrace that, you're going to struggle with two sins. What are they? Jealousy and envy. I could have practiced hand and finger exercises to infinity and never caught Bob. Anyway, Saul didn't fare well. The old adage is true, that power corrupts, and absolute power does what? Absolutely corrupts. He's absolutely corrupted. Verse 9, Saul looked at David after this little episode with suspicion from that day on. He read David through the lens of jealousy and envy. So that anything David does, he's thinking about, he's trying to take the kingdom from me, and I want what he's got. You have to stop and ask yourself the uncomfortable question, is jealousy and envy destroying your relationships? Because that's exactly what it does. Somebody got promoted, they made colonel, you didn't make colonel. You're a lieutenant colonel, you wish you were colonel, but you're not going to make it. It's your third look, they passed you over. You know you're way better than that other guy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's stuff like that. You get a new job, you got great ideas, no one listens to you, they hire somebody else, and next thing you know, they're doing all of his ideas at the other cubicle. You're like, what's going on over there? It's that kind of thing, jealousy, envy. So if you struggle with that, then learn from Saul not to live like Saul, but to live like a David. It says in verse 10, it came about on the next day that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of his house while David was playing the harp with his hand, as usual, and a spear was in Saul's hand. What's he thinking? I'll just take him out. Then I won't be jealous anymore. Saul hurled the spear at four. He thought, I will pin David to the wall. But David escaped because he's young and agile. His presence, two times this happened. Now Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him, but he departed from Saul. I mean, he threw his spear at him two times at close range, and he missed. Who was with David? God, who was not with Saul. God wasn't with him. What we read in this passage is that because Saul is overcome with jealousy and envy, and God has removed his blessing from him, God permits a demonic spirit, which is what I've already told you it was in the last passage we studied this, he removes the protective hedge, like in Job chapter 1, where the devil comes and tells God in God's throne room, hey, if you consider Job, just remove your protective hedge and I will make him curse you. God says, okay, I'll take you on that test. And we know how that fared for Job eventually. That's what you have here. David's harp playing, for some reason, really soothed Saul's mental trauma. But he so hated him, was so jealous of him, so envious of him, he thought, well, I'll just kill him outright, and then I won't have to deal with him anymore. That didn't work. Verse 13, therefore Saul removed him from his presence and appointed him as a commander of 1,000. And he went out and he came in before the people. So I tried 2 times to spear him, didn't work. So I'll stick him over 1,000 soldiers who are in battle all the time. Probability of him getting killed, great. So I'll just stick him out there. That'd be great. So I'll remove him from my presence so I don't have to look at him. It says in verse 14 that David was prospering in all the ways for the Lord was with him. When Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, he dreaded him. But all of Israel and Judah loved him. And he went out and he came out before him. I mean, Saul's trying to get rid of his competition, and everything he does to destroy him and cancel him, God's like, nah, that's not going to work. I'm going to bless David. So Saul's got a problem. Plan number two. He's going to launch into, I'll get him to marry my oldest daughter. This will work. Saul said to David, here's my older daughter, Merab. I wouldn't have married her just because of the name. I mean, like, Merab. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be valiant, be a valiant man for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul thought, my hand shall not be against him. Like, I don't want to personally kill him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. Let the enemy take him out so he dies gloriously on the battlefield. He won't really have to marry my daughter per se. But what Saul was doing was, if you want to marry the king's daughter and you're from this little no-name backwater town and you don't have a whole lot of money, I'll make it possible, but you got to fight so many battles. And when you fight so many battles, whatever they were, that doesn't say in the text, after you finish your last one, then she'll be yours. It didn't fly with David. Verse 18, David said to Saul, who am I? What is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be the king's son-in-law? I mean, see the humility? He goes, no. And David was probably beginning to connect the dots, because if your possible future father-in-law tried to kill you 2 times with a spear, you're probably not going to want to marry that girl, right? King Saul, what he did, he turned to verse 19. It came about at that time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel, the Maholathite, for a wife. So, okay, well, honey, you go marry this guy. David, he doesn't want to marry you. That doesn't stop Saul, because jealousy and envy, it's like a monster. Verse 20, now Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. And when they told Saul that she did, the thing was agreeable to him. He's like, this is exciting. And Saul thought, I will give her to him that she may become a helpmate to him. No, a snare to him, that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. I'll get him to marry daughter number 2, but she'll be a snare insofar as I'm going to set up a scenario where he's on a battlefield and he's going to get killed. So he won't really have to marry her, but we're going to do something to take him out. So corrosive is what you find when you see jealousy and envy. It says, therefore, Saul said to David, for a second time, you may be my son-in-law today. Then Saul commanded his servants, speak to David secretly, saying, behold, the king delights in you and all of his servants love you. And now, therefore, become the king's son-in-law. He's appealing to David's baser desires. Everyone loves you. Just marry my daughter and you'll have royal power. It says in verse 23, servants spoke to David these words. And David says, it's a trivial thing in your sight to become the king's son-in-law, since I am a poor man and highly lightly esteemed. Translated, I don't have any money. I can't pay for the dowry. So verse 24, servants reported to Saul according to the words which David spoke. And Saul said, thus you shall say to David, the king does not desire any dowry, like a bunch of money, except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, to take vengeance on the king's enemies. Now Saul planned to make David fall by the hand of his Philistines. He wanted to get rid of him. He says, okay, you can marry her. Just go kill 100 Philistines. Take their foreskins. I know this is gruesome. Take their foreskins off their dead bodies. Bring them back to me and she's yours. It says in verse 26 that David kind of caved. and took him up on the offer. When his servants told David these words, it pleased David to become the king's son-in-law. Before the days had expired, David rose up, went, and he and his men, his valiant men, struck down 200 men of the Philistines. Then David brought their foreskins, not 100, but 200, double, and gave them in full number to the king, as gross as that is, that he might become the king's son-in-law. And so Saul gave him, reluctantly, Michal, his daughter, for a wife. He tried to get David killed. That's what jealousy and envy does. It does unbelievable things in your life. It drives you to do unbelievable things. Do you struggle with it? When David became his son-in-law, it says in verse 28, when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, then Saul was even more afraid of David. He's scared to death of him because he can't stop anything that David does. It says in verse 29 that Saul was David's enemy continually. Terrible. Two things destroyed Saul: his jealousy of David and his envy of David. It says in verse 30, then the commanders of the Philistines went out to battle, and it happened as often as they went out that David behaved himself even more wisely than all the servants of Saul. So his name was highly esteemed. You could not stop David. Why? God's hand was on him. He would be the king that would exemplify the Messiah that would come. From this story, we learn about the dangers of jealousy and envy. But the main motif that I see in relationship to that is this: when jealousy and envy move someone in your life to bring you down, God providentially works to build you up and bless you. You might need to read that two times. Whoever that person is, that's your soul, they will not be victorious. Why? Because God himself goes before you to bless you and build you up. You might say then, well, why did God take David through such hard times? Why didn't he just make him the king? Because God's more interested in about shaping the inner man. And he used years of hardship to shape David to become who he wanted him to be as the king. And that's how God used that whole terrible situation, as he's using your terrible situation to prepare you for greater things. So hold on. And if you're a person that struggles with jealousy and envy, I'm here today to tell you, you can find forgiveness and freedom at the feet of Christ. And he just waits for you to show up and say, Lord, forgive me and make me a new person, and he will. Let me pray. God, thank you for a great story about sins that we struggle with all too readily. Deliver us from them. Deliver us from the soul types. Give us great hope of what lies ahead, that even in the hardness, you prepare us for greater things. And we will bless you as we're obedient unto you. And we thank you for just the opportunity to study your inspired text. May it change us, in Christ's name. Amen.